This is your community radio station, WCOM, Chapel Hill, Carborough 103.5. Tofu Dave here with another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie. And today I have on the line the author and UNC professor, author of Native Nations, A Millennium in North America, Kathleen Duval. Good afternoon, Dr.
Good
Duval.
Afternoon.
How are you?
I'm great. It's so nice to be here with you here in Chapel Hill.
Well, you know, instead of my trying to summarize for you what you're trying to do in this new book that I found really interesting, why don't you give my listeners the elevator pitch on Native Nations?
Great. I'd love to. Yeah. So really my impetus in writing this book was that I think a lot of Americans today see Native Americans in lots of places today, in public office, with cases before the Supreme Court and television and movies. And I think for a lot of non-Native Americans, it's hard to sort of square that really public, active presence of Native Americans today with what most of us were taught in U.S. history. U.S. history tends to portray Native Americans as people of the past that sort of suffered from colonization and disease and warfare and declined pretty rapidly. And so I'm a historian, and so what I wanted to do with this book was really to bridge this gap for readers, to show, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Millennium in North America, really show a millennium of the history of Native Americans before colonialism, before 1492, surviving through colonialism and still surviving today and into the future. And I would say there's sort of one major point of the book is that Native Americans have survived, not just as individual Native Americans, not just as a minority group within the United States, but as nations, that today there are more than 500 federally recognized Native American nations within the United States. That's not even counting our really important state recognized tribes. So lots and lots of Native nations, and the Native Americans, they're sort of one of their primary identities is as a member of their particular Native nation, not just as a general Native American as well.
Right. And I think nations, that's an important point. Nations and millenniums, so thousands of years, sovereign nations. And one of the things I found real interesting in your book, if I start with that sort of millennium back approach, is you had some real interesting stuff about how some of the Native nations interacted with the Dutch in North America and the French. And one of the things that struck me was your discussion of the Mohawk Nation and how they really, I would say almost, well, diabolically isn't a nice word, but they really, in a way, manipulated the Dutch and really had a big effect on global market economics. Could you just give us a little taste of that? How far off am I?
That's exactly, maybe not the diabolical part, but all the rest of it, the manipulating and shaping global markets. Absolutely. And so, the Mohawks, just one of many, many nations who established trade with Europeans pretty early. Now, I want to be clear, you know, there's some Native nations that, suffer terribly from colonialism early, and then plenty that do later. But there are some nations that are quite powerful, like the Mohawks, who in their early interactions and for decades in their relationships with a European group are really able to control that relationship. So in this particular case, the Mohawks, they recruit Dutch trade. They persuade the Dutch to build a trading post at what today is Albany, that the Mohawks really control. The Mohawks will bring in furs and skins that are then sent to Europe by the Dutch. But then they buy the kind of Dutch products that they want. They buy the kinds of things we sort of know that Native Americans bought in this era, guns and knives and kettles. But they also buy bread and cookies, and they are a huge part of the local economy of the Dutch colony of New Netherland. And then, you know, as you say, they end up, their demand for goods ends up shaping what even, you know, European manufacturers are making. So they demand a particular kind of guns and particular kinds of axes. And so those are made to their specifications in Europe.
so interesting. And then I'm going to sort of follow this time sequence for a minute, if I may.
Yeah.
Another thing that struck me in your book, in this quick overview of Native nations, was your talk of the Cherokees in particular, partly, I guess, because of living in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
We still
yeah.
have a strong Cherokee nation today. That
right, right.
A lot of especially Western North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that sort of shocked me in your book was the degree to which the Cherokee nation engaged in slavery and enslaved people in back in, oh, I don't remember the exact years, but in the 1700s and into the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
If I read your book correctly, you allege that the Cherokee nation practiced slavery, particularly of African Americans, really to the same extent that the settler population engaged in slavery. Did I read it
right? And yeah, and it's really in this and in these early decades of the 1800s, moving toward the what ends up being Indian removal, and sort of changing the course of Cherokee history. But before that, before removal, very similarly to settler populations, the majority of settlers in even the southern colonies don't own slaves themselves. It's just some. It's a fairly large group of elite families that that enslave people. And the same is true among the Cherokees. Most Cherokees do not engage in slavery. Most Cherokees don't enslave people in the 19th century. But there is a group of wealthier families that have made fortunes off of enslaved labor, and they're growing the same kinds of crops that their white southern neighbors are growing in that era. And I think one of the things that's really important for people to understand is that those all kinds of Cherokees, they're people of their time. Native Americans today are people of today. Cherokees of the early 1800s were people of the early 1800s. And it's people who made fortunes in the South in 1825. We're doing it with a plantation and by enslaving human beings. And so the Cherokees also in this era, they write a written constitution, but they're doing it not because they're just trying to copy white people, which is what it's sometimes described as, but instead because that's what they think a modern 19th century nation does. It writes down its constitution. So I think one of the purposes of this book is to see Native Americans over time as being part of world history, being part of U.S. history, not being separate from that, not being alien or primitive or different, but living in their, in their time and place.
In their time. So ironic. We only have a few minutes left. Again, this is Kathleen Duval, the author of Native Nations and professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Yes, it sounds a little bit to me like we've got the 1% now, and I guess we've had the 1% throughout, let's say, capitalist and even, to my surprise, Native American history a lot. Sort of an interesting commentary on human beings. And let's jump
right.
on.
Although,
sorry. Go ahead.
I will say earlier in the book, I do talk about sort of these more complex, diverse economies that Native people develop in the 1200s and 1300s, which really are the opposite of that. That are all about reciprocity and establishing trade relationships with people who will help you in bad times and that you'll help in bad times. So there are lots of different ways and maybe some better lessons for the possibility of humanity and other times and places.
Well, let's quickly jump to the present in the couple minutes we have left. Kathleen Duval, author of Native Nations, A Millennium in North America, out on Random House. Let's jump right to today and some things on some of my listeners' minds in previous discussions have been issues of gambling and playing the lottery and games of chance. And, of course, one of, I would guess, as an urban myth right now, is a lot of the gambling casinos are Native Nation run. We've got Hurrah Casino in Western North Carolina, I believe, run by the owned by the Cherokee Nation.
Mm-hmm.
Right over the border in Danville, Virginia, there's been a lot of turmoil recently because somehow, I'm not sure of all the details, laws changed and one of the Native Nations has built a huge casino right over the North Carolina border in Danville. Can you just give us a minute overview of the business economics now of Native Nations, and do these kinds of things really end up helping the lives of us, of the common people in the Native Nations, when we hear about casinos and wealth coming?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so I think the most important thing to understand about casinos, about Indian casinos, is that they're based in sovereignty. So Native Nations today in the United States have federally recognized Native Nations have a certain sovereign rights under U.S. law to run their own sort of tribal governments and tribally owned businesses. And so the right to have a casino comes out of that, the kinds of state laws that may apply to gambling don't directly apply within tribal nations. So the thing is that tribal nations, their sovereignty means they are under the sovereignty of the United States, but they are not under the sovereignty of state government. So if the United States had, you know, if the United States outlawed gambling, there would not be gambling allowed within any Native nations. But state laws regarding gambling don't directly affect tribal gambling. They still have to come to compacts with states. They have to still come to agreements with states, but it's more of a sovereignty to sovereignty agreement rather than a state law that applies to tribes. And the same is true for all kinds of other things that tribes do. And so what a lot of tribes themselves then get to make the decision about how to run a casino and how to distribute those profits. Many of the tribes just do it on a per capita basis. Each tribal member gets a certain amount per year, depending on how much the casino made. Others put a lot of money into tribal government funds for education and other things like that. So the tribe gets to decide those things. It's definitely not just going to a handful of tribal members. And then what sort of wise tribes have done is they've used that for tribes that have casinos. Most tribes don't have casinos, but the tribes that do have casinos have been able to use that money to then start other tribal businesses, tribal ranching businesses. I know it's been coffee and chocolate, all kinds of businesses that tribes have either established themselves or made small business loans to tribal members to establish. And really, some tribes have become models, such as the Quapaw Nation that I talk about in my book, have become models of sort of diversifying their tribal businesses and their tribally owned businesses to sort of move into a future, you know, with or without casinos, but definitely not to depend on casinos as, say, you know, the main source of funding for the tribal government or something like that.
Great information, Professor Kathleen Duvall, author of Native Nations, A Millennium in North America. Thank you for taking the time to talk to our community radio listeners. Any final words before we sign off from our...
No, I just want to say, yeah, thank you so much, Dave, for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks again. This is Tofu Dave with another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie on your community radio station, WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carver. See you next time.